been wonderful to see how people have used the gift of language in so many different ways, which is a gift in itself. And I also hope that that helps you to bear with me how I use this gift. And of course, it's shaped around a particular purpose and goal, but it is also shaped by my cultural roots and upbringing. When my almost 9-year-old grandson tried to read the title of my presentation, he stumbled over every single word. And I said, yes, it is a cumbersome title, but every single word in it is an important dimension of what I want to talk about. And the most important question that kind of motivated me to put those three pieces together is, what is all this effort for? Where are we going and how are we getting there? In this presentation, I will be walking on Hope's Edge, which is the title of a book by Frances Moore LaPay and her daughter, Anna LaPay. I first focus on what has been pushing our little planet closer to Hope's very edge by looking at the way migrant domestic workers or trafficked women are being used, abused, or used up. In the second part of the presentation, I look at the radical political message that migrant domestic workers and trafficked women give us, give to the world. They push our understanding of gift labor a bit further by laying bare its physical, bodily, place, and earthbound grounding, and how that can be, must be, the grounding for transnational global political connections. Their stories also tell us that we need to be both place-bound and nomadic. And they also tell us that we cannot disaggregate personal from social transformation. For the past three decades, my main political interests and concerns have been with international and sexual divisions of labor around the notion of subsistence work. Because raising children or mother work is primarily oriented towards sustaining life, it is a prime example of subsistence work. And as Genevieve has pointed out, it is also paradigmatic for gift labor. Moreover, and that is my emphasis here, it is place-bound work, and it is tied to the physical necessities, the blood, guts, and gore of real, messy life. I previously investigated how this place-bound work is inserted in a political economy of race-class segregation in the inner city of Chicago, where I live. Here, mothers do place-bound work in a confined, sectioned-off space. The welfare debate of the 90s, culminating in the 1996 Welfare Act in the US, did not criticize any racial economic segregations or confinements, nor did it criticize the relocation of jobs to cheap labor countries, jobs most inner-city residents held in the steel or car industry. It did, however, criticize, by vilifying the place-bound nature of the work, welfare mothers, also referred to as welfare queens, were doing. The government had to pay for work that made women get stuck in one place. They clearly had to become mobile, had to get away from their kids or disappear between the cracks of a punitive welfare system and of economic realities that offer jobs only to some and only for non-living wages. It is not difficult to see a link between this enforced mobility and the growing internationalization of domestic and cleaning work. In order for the state to reduce its expenses or to receive remittances badly needed to pay back loans to the IMF or World Bank, mothers have to be torn from their children. The children then become the invisible and never talked about little figures being pushed around in an abysmal or non-existing childcare system in the US, or being taken care of back home in the Netherlands of a private household. At the current stage in the patriarchal capitalist game, trafficking in women and the flow of migrant women, a term I read in many of the studies, across the globe are part and parcel of the overall transformation of national economies. Motherhood and sexuality are an integral, logical part of import-export schemes that are typical for this new economy, where poor countries export or send enrich or richer countries import or receive. Mobile motherhood and mobile sex are intricately tied to capital mobility and to the extractive nature of a predatory finance capitalism. There are often tremendous cultural differences and geographical distances between so-called sending and receiving countries, and all countries have their own variations of patriarchal cultural practices. However, it is the patriarchal capitalist underbelly that provides the connective tissue of all paid or unpaid versions of a kind of labor that has always supported a capitalist interior infrastructure of service and servitude, one that has now simply gone global. It is only logical that the US military was the institution that introduced organized prostitution to the Philippines. Here, ordinary guns are joined by hard, erect penis guns. We can add to this arsenal of guns the gene gun, or what Genevieve Vaughan calls the phallic father money of the financial money gamblers. These guns are all pointed at real, organic, imperfect bodies or organisms. They blast DNA-coded particles into live, not yet modified organisms. They make bodies do what is profitable or pleasurable, penetrate them and dispose of them once they are no longer useful, or they simply bomb them out of existence. Global trafficking in women's bodies or sex home delivery to American GIs and rape of live-in maids to order in the privacy of individual households are all variations of the same greedy contempt for women's sexuality and birthing capacity. Real life is extracted from real bodies by trading them as disposable sex toys that get shipped back once American GIs infected them, or disposable domestic workers. Extraction is part and parcel of keeping in check such real life or real life capacity. Profitable capitalist patriarchal assaults on migrant women's bodies often result in death. For instance, as reported by Gabriela, a US-Philippine women's solidarity organization, one coffin per day is sent back to the Philippines with the body of a woman killed as a domestic or sex worker. Foreign domestics are aliens from a different culture and they are non-citizens, which marks and regulates them as bonded or enslaved laborers. Or they are undocumented illegals desperate enough to put up with any kind of abuse. Pierre Tondonio Sotelo lists various agency names in the Los Angeles area, which he studied. Mamas made to order, domestic darlings, made in heaven, or custom made for you. She also observed that the name the maids themselves give to all of them is domestic desperation. In the United States, the workers' immigrant status provides the most powerful axis of inequality, especially with respect to live-in domestic workers. The informal privacy of individual, isolated households deliberately invites keeping desperate undocumented immigrants in slave-like conditions. Live-in jobs, the typical point of entry for Latina immigrants, are therefore described as prisons where te encierra, you lock yourself up. Moreover, the Fair Labor Standard Act completely exempts live-in employees from overtime coverage. There exists some limited protective labor laws. Not surprisingly, those who, quote, work as personal attendants, for example, babysitters, caregivers to young children, or companions of the elderly or infirm, are explicitly excluded from the right to earn minimum wage and overtime pay. The laws cover those who clean and care for material possessions. If those who do private care work want to have the same legal rights, they must show that they devote at least 20% of their work time to housekeeping duties. In the US, the most powerful minority world country, the provisions of special visas allow foreign national diplomats and IMF and World Bank officials to import domestic help. B1 is a catch-all business category, and the State Department keeps no records of domestic helpers imported under its provisions. The workers suffer some of the most blatant abuses, from having to sleep outside with a family dog, being sexually harassed, or working for 16 hours per day all week long for $100 a month. The State Department does keep record of the whereabouts of A3 and G5 domestic workers, but this information is classified as confidential for the privacy of the employer. Not surprisingly, the women often live as prisoners in the homes they clean. All forms of hyperregulation, indentured servitude, or enslavement are interwoven with seemingly endless variations of racialization practices, abetted by an equally diverse array of immigration policies, government-sponsored labor import of foreign contract labor programs, national regulatory regimes, and the action of placement or employment agencies, brothel owners, or sex traffickers. I condense a lot of information here, and I don't know that. Some labor importation or employment schemes hide the racialness of alien labor by camouflaging it with terms such as foreign, or by using the ability or inability to speak English as a code for national and ethnic stereotypical preferences. In other contexts, companies in the global sex business see absolutely no need to camouflage racialized attributes. In Germany or the Netherlands, for instance, brochures use racializations as advertisement turn-ons that praise slim, sunburned, and sweet wares because they love the white man in an erotic and devoted way, or because, as little slaves, they give real Thai warmth. The image that keeps popping up for me is one of stratus dwellers, the speculators in the stratosphere of casino capitalism, who get a kick out of looking down upon the entertaining dramas enacted by female employees, by female employers and their female employees on the interior public stage of private isolated households. They may chuckle when an employer withholds the pay for her live-in maid in order to keep her from running away, where she gives her sub-minimum wage, but extends her working hours into the night, or where she subjects her to intimate scrutiny and control of her sexual life. Foreign domestic sex life is also severely monitored or controlled by various national regulatory regimes or allocation systems. A work permit may only be given if the imported domestic worker agrees not to marry a native-born man. She also has to, or at least pretend to be, single. Or where she has children, these have to remain back home. The children of prostituted women workers in American military bases are treated as disposable as their mothers. As Ninochka Rochka from Gabriela told me, the children grow up in severe poverty and without education or any other social services. When I asked her what the women can do to protect themselves from becoming pregnant, she said they are discouraged from doing so because the Catholic Church does not allow any form of contraception. In other words, the power of money to force all life into prostitution or Christian pimping, as Claudia pointed out, that lies at the very core of the patriarchal capitalist economy, means controlling the use of a woman's sexuality, and it easily blends in with the religious act of taking away women's agency as regards their birthing power. The patriarchal stratus dwellers have been busily at work in their urge to find ways of bringing life processes under total control, of purifying the impurity of sexuality and birthing, or as Claudia said, of following their dream of a birthing machine that does away altogether with the need for impure, dirty mother bodies. DNA has now obtained the alchemical status of coding and therefore creating quintessential pure life. It can be extracted from real, that is, impure life, and it can be shelved in a DNA library where bacteria colonies provide identical copies of an original DNA fragment. DNA-coded particles can then be blasted into cells via microprojectiles, the ballistic method, or propelled via electrical discharge into plant material, the Excel method. While there are other less violent methods, the fact that the gene gun is a commonplace name and tool in the field of transgenic modification is almost reassuringly non-surprising. It is also not surprising that in the US we hear only of the successes of fast-growing chicken or pesticide-resistant corn, but not of the failures associated with the unpredictability of the impure, messy part of live plants or animals. How many people in the US know that entire transgenic crops fail to grow the way they were modified to do, thus driving thousands of indebted farmers to suicide? Who has heard about hundreds of failed animal cloning experiments where the animals suffered from arthritis, gastric ulcer, diabetes, or where salmon delivered deformed heads, jaws, and gill flaps? It's now time to look at the other side of hope's edge. Instead of joining the status dwellers by speculating on the utopian possibilities of a cyber technology they created, I rather look at the fate of millions of people all over the globe. Most of humankind neither surfs the net nor has access to the disembodied experiences of a virtual reality. Women's reality of being cut or penetrated is not a simulated version of cyber sex, nor is it that of women who have their breast size reduced or enlarged. Both groups are at opposite ends of the patriarchal pole that nevertheless unites them. Both groups live the patriarchal script. How can we then move, I ask, from a global culture that glorifies virtual technobodies in corporate cyberspace and extracts the life out of real flesh and blood bodies who keep moving from place to place and who are picking up after the lords of cyberspace, the status dwellers, and after their children? How can we stay grounded in our physical, bodily, place-bound reality and reach across vast geographical and cultural distances? Where is our anchor? As an alien resident in the United States, I have been studying various writings on diaspora living. Home is a recurrent motif in these writings. Some writers focus primarily on the big home and describe the anguish of national relocations or displacements, of living in exile or in a diaspora, of transnational migrations. There are, of course, also analyses of the little home. They address the presumably mundane tasks and experiences associated with daily living in a small place and space. We all know that experiences in the little home are fully embedded in problematic normative assumptions and larger social power relations. Other writers, such as bell hooks, for instance, emphasize how a physical home place provides safety, especially in a hostile social environment, and how doing home therefore includes work that benefits the well-being of an entire community. And with Maria talked about it. The collection of essays in This Bridge We Call Home is exemplary for revealing the many hidden social, cultural, and political connections between the big home and the little home. I believe that replacing domestic with home can ignite a flare of radical political sparks. The very word domestic conjures up images of narrowness, smallness, docility, or violently enforced captivity. On the other hand, home can link the smallness of a concrete place with the largeness of wide open space. Gloria Anzaldúa writes that home is that bridge, the in-between place of nepantla in constant transition, the most unsafe of all spaces. She refers to the struggles of a traveler in transition to a new way of seeing herself and herself in relation to others and to the world. Migrant domestic workers' experience speak more directly and more brutally of home, not only as the most unsafe of all spaces, but also of all places. Yet, these workers are also messengers of an embodied, grounded Nepantla. They are walking hope's edge. Many Filipina migrant workers, for instance, have shown that it's possible to develop transnational bonds or transnational family ties. In other words, they show us possibilities of transnational homemaking. At the same time, The work of migrant nannies, housekeepers also shows that the hope isn't clear or tidy, that it has an edge, that it is messy, as it is woven into place-bound care work. Walking on hope's razor-sharp edge therefore means being able to form transnational bonds and simultaneously being able to form strong emotional bonds with a foreign employer's children, and this despite the fact that one's own children are far away and one can see them only once in a blue moon. This is the message for global feminism. We can or should be place-bound as well as moving, anchored in the bodies and the land's multiple needs and gift offerings, but also transmigratory or nomadic. In other words, we can be at home both in our own place and space and in the world at large by constructing a nomadic home. Such a transitional home place links the recognition and affirmation of a concrete, solid place to the recognition and affirmation of many other concrete, solid places in different social, cultural, and political spaces that together build the foundations of our world. I have only a few more minutes, so bear with me. Sex workers, maids, and nannies have to navigate between many kinds of externally violently imposed norms and expectations regarding servicing employers or clients' needs and desires. However, both care and sex work are inseparable from primary bodily events, that is, birth and sexuality. At the same time, there are fundamental differences between cleaning a house, serving male sexual desires, and taking care of children's well-being, whether corresponding norms and expectations are self-imposed or externally forced upon the actors. Caring for children is of a different order than cleaning a house. And whereas sexuality can be experienced as a powerful life force that may or may not be linked to the creation of new life, celebrating that life force is nevertheless fundamentally different from the actual physical giving of life. Likewise, assuming responsibility for one's own sexual or sexual partner's well-being is also quite different from assuming responsibility for the care of new life. Once born, a child reminds us daily and nightly of the bodily, messy grounding of life, of being alive. Care work is not simply about reproducing humankind. It is about sustaining life by making and letting it grow in a way that affirms its physical, material, bodily grounding. If we want to be not only critical of neoliberalism and neopatriarchy, but also eager to advance new ways of understanding, we must foreground the existence and needs of children, both in our theory and our practice. Regardless of where they live and under what circumstances, children's need for care is universal. How we greet, carry out, and ultimately transform this universal need into work that sustains life in general is a question that points to larger, all-embracing responsibilities. The African-American migrant women in the United States East Bay community made that point quite clear by considering children as the freshest link in the web of reciprocal obligations. It is this universal collective and reciprocal obligation that provides the concrete physical, spiritual foundation for making connections between people and places that may be separated by vast geographical, geopolitical, and cultural distances. These connections can be expanded, translated into reciprocal obligations to safeguard, repair, or rebuild the conditions of life that is our future. In this conference, some of you are specifically addressing one of our body's vital dimensions I can here only hint at. The body is an entity that is intricately intertwined with the earth, the land upon which it walks or rests, and from which it draws its nourishment. Gloria Anzaldúa declares the body to be the royal road to consciousness, and that the body, quote, is rooted in the earth, la tierra itself. You meet ensoulment in trees, in woods, in streams. The roots del árbol de la vida of all planetary beings are nature, soul, body. Planetary homemaking means caring for the foundations of life, for the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the land on which we grow our food, safeguarding biodiversity and the integrity of individual life forms are therefore integral components of making the world a home for all. Planetary homemaking means creating a life-affirming big home that is attentive to the universal yearning for being grounded, for being safe, for belonging, and for finding shelter, rest, and physical, spiritual nourishment. I think the metaphor of a topographical map is particularly useful here, especially with respect to its central aspect, the contour lines. Contour lines is a quote, a lines of constant elevation connecting places at precisely the same altitude to reveal a terrain's three-dimensional shape. Cindy Katz suggests that we use this metaphor as a tool for imagining a politics that maintains the distinctness of a place while recognizing that it is connected analytically to other places, and that this along contour lines that represent not elevation, but particular relations to a process. In her case, she talks about a globalizing capitalist relations of production. But the map metaphor not only allows us to make critical analytical connections between people's unique relations to capitalist forces of production, or more precisely, of extraction. It also lets us mark the places where we are located, where we are at home, collectively and individually, in our bodies, on the land, the earth, the world. This means that we can also find deeply felt connections, but only if we reach a certain place within ourselves. Ansel Dürr's complex and elaborate story of how we can move through the seven stages of conocimiento if we want to develop different relations to self, others, and the world tell us of the inner work we have to do by walking on hope's thin and razor-sharp edge. Although we are all starting such a journey from very different places and spaces, the points I have one more minute, okay. Ansel Dürr addresses may be helpful guides for this inner work. The journey starts from what appears safe or familiar to us, moves us into the transitional in-between space of Nepantla, and onto despair and self-loathing when we begin to see our thought traps, our emotional intellectual presence we all experience. But these moments are also beginnings of a spiritual conversion where we critically rearrange the patches of our reality. When we move on to testing this new reality out in the world, different realities are bound to clash. The disappointment with ourselves and others can also become the critical turning points of transformation where we shift realities, develop an ethical, compassionate strategy with which to negotiate conflicts and difference within self and between others. This journey, this walking on hope's edge, gives us a glimpse into the terrifying, challenging, but also inspiring tasks that are still and continue to remain ahead of us, no matter whether and how often we have already been moving through various stages of conocimiento and nomadic becoming. It makes us see points of elevation or contour lines of counter topographies where our walk on hope's edge means making analytical and deeply felt connections across cultures, languages, and places of origin.